Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552, or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. As drummer for Vanilla Fudge, Carmine Appice set the grooves for the groundbreaking band's 1967 psychedelic debut, inadvertently inventing stoner rock in the process. The Fudge had no precedent. The band was totally unique. No rock group until that point had ever stretched out well-known pop tunes. Vanilla Fudge went on the tour with Jimi Hendrix, Cream, and even had Led Zeppelin as an opening act. Post-Fudge, Bogart and Appice formed Cactus. Post-Cactus, the rhythm section found Grammy-winning guitar hero Jeff Beck to form the first supergroup, Beck, Bogart, and Appice. One of the premier showmen in rock, Appice became known worldwide for his astonishing live performances and a highly sought-after session drummer, recording with countless artists throughout his career. 1976, he joined Rod Stewart's band, touring, recording, and writing two of Stewart's biggest hits, Do You Think I'm Sexy and Young Turks. He left Stewart to record his first solo album, Rockers, and tour Japan and North America with an all-star band. In 1978, Appice played drums on Paul Stanley's first solo album. In the early 1980s, he toured with Ozzy Osbourne, Ted Nugent. In the mid-80s, he formed King Cobra for two Capitol albums and international touring. In the late 80s, Carmine played on Pink Floyd's Momentary Lapse of Reason and formed a Blue Murder with Whitesnake's John Sykes and the firm's Tony Franklin. In the early 90s, he pounded away soul style for the Edgar Winter Group. As an educator, Carmine was the first to legitimize rock drumming with his landmark book, The Realistic Rock Drum Method, selling over 400,000 copies. He was the first rock drummer and rock musician to conduct instructional clinics and symposiums around the world, a tradition he continues. In appreciation for his universal appeal, Los Angeles was one of four cities that have had Carmine Appice Day. In 1991, he was forever immortalized via his induction in cement to the Hollywood's Rock Walk next to Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich. In 2016, Carmine wrote an autobiography titled Stick It, which appeared on Amazon's bestsellers list. As a true artist, Carmine stretches the limits of his talents, always pursuing new experiences with a broad spectrum of musicians. His high standards have earned him the respect of the world's most admired performers, as well as captivating the loyalty of legions of fans. He has reshaped the path of music education, redesigned the very instrument he plays, and recreates excitement with every performer. Carmine Appice is truly a different drummer. Please welcome legendary drummer, singer, songwriter, and author, Carmine Appice, to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Carmine.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, man.
Good, man. That was a hell of an intro.
Well, it's hard to get it all in there. You've done so much.
I know, right?
You know,
yeah, it's a long career, dude. It's a long career.
It really is. You know, I interview a lot of rock stars and celebrities, but you're the all-time multitasking champ.
Oh, okay. All right, I'll take that.
Well, I've had Mark Stein on the show. We were talking about the Mark Stein Project and, of course, Spirit of 67, which was an awesome album. Incredible.
Right. Thank you.
I had Don Brewer on the show on Tuesday, another drummer. The last time I saw you was at the Rock and Blues Fest, and your rendition of People Get Ready was just incredible, man.
Right.
I was actually fortunate to see Curtis Mayfield sing it in 1971, but, you know, you're quite a singer, besides being a drummer.
Well, thank you. You know, both of my popular songs, People Get Ready, and I'm So Proud, from the Beck Bogan Peace record, the Curtis Mayfield song, you know, I'm So Proud was his, and People Get Ready was his, too. Probably why we did People Get Ready, why we did I'm So Proud with BBA, because I had sang People Get Ready, and I was like that, and I was like I'm So Proud as well.
You've got an album, Carmen Epice's Guitar Zeus.
Carmine. You got to correct that front name.
What did I say?
Carmen.
Oh, did I say Car? Sorry about that. Carmine.
Yeah.
Now, this is the first ever album of its kind. It features 32 guitar icons with original songs never done before. And it's an incredible album. I think it was released this year, I think, in January, right? The re-release?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And, of course, it's available now. You can get it on Amazon. There's bonus songs on there. You've got one with Bumblefoot.
Yeah.
And, go ahead.
Are you on an internet line or something? Because you keep fading in and out.
Oh, really? Yeah, I am on a speaker. It's the only way we can do this recording.
Oh, okay. You know, because you're fading in and out a little bit. So I didn't hear what you said there. You're talking about the bonus track with Bumblefoot on it?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a track that wasn't on any of the albums previously. It was on 24 track. That I had I have a place where I store all the 24 tracks from my past and different tapes and different things. I'm moving into another room that doesn't have as much echo.
Okay, cool.
So I took that 24 track and I actually bounced it to digital, and then I listened to it and I noticed that everything was on it except the guest guitar player. So I asked Bumblefoot if he would play on it. He's a friend of mine, and he said, yeah, he would. And then he did, and once he played on it, I needed more guitar parts, and my mixer, Stevie D, plays guitar. He's a real good player, and I asked him to heavy up some of the riffs, and I needed some fills at the end of the song. So to distinguish the Bumblefoot from Stevie, we put Stevie on the right and the left of the mix, right, doing the fills at the end of the song after the solo. And then when Bumblefoot continues his solo, it goes right down the middle. So it's some good ear candy when you're listening to it. You'll hear something coming out, the vocal, then on the right guitar, then the left guitar, right guitar, left guitar, then down the middle. So if you listen to the whole record, a lot of the tracks, you'll notice there's a lot of really cool mixing ear candy, sort of like Beatles-ish, you know.
Right.
We had radio voices and answering the lead, or just like in the song called Safe, it goes down to a Mellotron, acoustic guitar, and a vocal. Usually the chorus goes up and builds up, but we wanted the chorus to build down on this one. You know, to prepare for the midsection when Neil Sean does a raving, amazing solo, you know. So that was the idea of the whole album, was just to make it a little different. And in the mixing, we made it a little different also.
Well, I gave it 5 stars, Carmine. I said there's enough great rock and roll on this album to last a lifetime.
Yeah, I agree. So far, it has lasted since 1995, 1997. And, you know, and I'm amazed that it still sounds good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because when we did it, we sort of used Soundgarden, Blue Murder, and the Beatles as influences for this record, you know. And the Beatles, not only songwriting and harmonies, but mixing as well, you know. Because, the Beatles had, you know, George Martin had certain ways of mixing things that, you know, had lots of ear candy in it. And that's what we tried to do.
Yeah, speaking of the Beatles, Gonna Rain sounds very Beatle-ish with Richie Valens.
Yes, it does.
Yep.
Yes, it does. And the beginning is that drum part that I'm playing, but we turned it backwards.
Right.
So it starts backwards and then it turns into front waves, you know? It goes backwards into forward. And it reappears again as a breakdown at the end of the song, which goes into, I believe it's a 5/4 timing. And it tried to make it really a progressive album with good guitar playing, great songs, good vocals, great hooks, but not being like your everyday 4/4 songs, you know?
Right. Yeah, being a drummer, man, it's great because you can get all these legendary guitar players to play with you, you know?
Well, that was the idea.
Yeah.
You know, when I came up with the concept, I was playing with Jeff Watson, Bob Davies, and Joe Montana. And we were going to call the band Zeus. We ended up calling it Mother's Army.
Right.
But Jeff had just gotten out of Night Range and got a record deal for a solo album like that, you know? But man, I've been trying to get a record deal for, you know, for about 10 years. I had one 10 years ago.
Right.
Solo album, and I was trying to get a new one. I said, what do I need to do? Be a guitar player? And I said, maybe I'll get a bunch of guitar players to play on my record and call it like Guitar Gods. And right. I was kidding around. I said, I'll call it Guitar Zeus, you know? And that night when I went to bed, you know, when you're in bed and your mind is racing and start thinking of things.
Right.
You know, I said, oh, you know, that's not a bad idea. You know? So then I started thinking about it and I started thinking how I could facilitate it. And while I was thinking about it, it took me a couple of years to find somebody to get a record deal. I ran into guys like Ted Nugent and Brian May and the guys from King's X. And I asked them if I did this album, would they play on it? And they said, yeah. So I knew I had some guys on it, and good ones, Brian May and Ted Nugent. I thought between those two guys, they influenced so many guitar players that are famous at that point, you know. And also at the time, you know, grunge was king.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And all us guys were like dinosaurs, you know. And nobody in America wanted to know about us. But in Europe and in Japan, it was still gun-ho, you know? So I ended up finding a guy in Warren Wyatt. He put the deal together out of Japan. Once I got the deal, I immediately called Brian and called Ted and had them pick the songs they wanted to do and send them tapes, you know? In Ted's situation, I actually went there to Michigan when he was in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny. He's over there recording and he's got a pistol in a holster on the back of his belt while he's playing guitar. So that was funny.
Well, you know, an animal might run into the studio. You never know.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's just funny. He's playing music and he's got a gun on his belt, you know?
Yeah.
And then at the same time, Yngwie had heard about it through Kelly Keeling, my singer. And he said he wanted to play on it. So in the same trip, I went to Florida first.
Right.
Get Yngwie. Then I went to Michigan to get Ted. Then I went to Houston and got the guy from King's X. It took me about a week, you know, traveling around. But I got everybody on there. And with Brian, I had to send them the tapes, you know. And then some people I had to send tapes, and some people, the rest of the people were in the studio in L.A. So it was quite an experience, you know.
I think it's one of the best albums in several decades. I really do, you know. And
best albums in what?
In over several decades, it's the best album.
Well, thank you. I love it. I mean, I think it's the best stuff I've ever done. I mean, creatively, production-wise. Great songs. You know, I just think the timing of it was a bit wrong for America. I did really well in Europe with it. I did well in Japan with it. I even did a Guitar Zeus Korea, a Guitar Zeus Japan. And, you know, I got a lot of mileage out of the project, you know. project. And, you know, over the years, it we probably sold 150,000, 170,000 records around the world, everywhere but America, you know. And, you know, I tried to get it out in 2004. The label came out, called it the Carmine and Thieves Project, put it on iTunes, and put it on Spotify and that kind of stuff. I'm trying to get that stuff off because, you know, it shouldn't be up there anymore. The label went out of business, and they didn't have the right to put that up there.
Right.
So I don't know who's getting the money for it, but I'm certainly not. And then in 2009, I put it out again with Fuel Records. They just put out a double CD of the first and second album with no bonus tracks. And, you know, same problem there. I was getting paid from that, but they didn't do anything for it, you know?
Yeah.
I wanted this album to come out in America with a bit of PR like we're doing now, where people will know about it. Even though those two labels released it here, nobody knew about it, you know? I mean, I don't even know if you knew about it, you know? Did you know about it before this?
Yes, I did.
Oh, you did? Well, you're one of the few. Well, you know, not a lot. And then I was going to get a catalog deal for it now, just to get it released so people could buy it.
Right.
You know, where I would actually get the royalties because the Fuel label sold it to another company and they still have it up on all the digital platforms. And they're not supposed to. I'm trying to get it off because I'm doing press on this stuff. And, you know, somebody goes to Spotify and they see this version and other versions. But this version has the most. This has 33 tracks to it. The other ones don't have that many. And we have all the bonus tracks, which includes the Bumblefoot track,
right,
which was never released. A track called Angels with Shaw, who's the Jet Set of Japan, is a great song, great player. A song called Nothing that has John Norum on it from Europe.
Yep.
And Do You Think I'm Sexy with Pat Travis and myself. And is there missing one? I think that's it. So those are the bonus tracks, and they're not on the other copies available anywhere. We have it out on CD, but on CD, unfortunately, we only have 12 tracks. And then it's coming out on vinyl in a couple of weeks. So we only have 8 tracks.
Right.
So it goes down from 33 to 12 to 8. But the vinyl looks good. It's a colored vinyl, and the artwork is pretty cool. So, you know, at least we're getting it out now. And, you know, it was Robert DePole from Primary Waves I did it. So, look, you got to get it out, but you got to keep the digital rights because that's where it's all going. Because shortly Netflix is going to be getting out of downloads, and it's just going to be Apple streaming.
Right.
You know, and he said, and the only ones who make money on that are the labels.
Yeah.
So, since I had the rights, he said, you should release it on your own label for digital. And if you want to get a catalog deal, that's fine.
Right.
But in trying to get a catalog deal, nobody wanted to take the Tarzus without the digital rights. So I released it on my own label, Rocker Records, which I've had going for a few years. And I've got some, you know, maybe 6 to 10 releases on there, including Cactus and me and Tim Bob Ridden Friends and me and Pat Travis and a couple other releases, Changeover Razors, which is a Chicago band, you know. And I said, well, I'll just release it on that. So that's what we done. We released it on Rocker Records physically, and I did my own release on the digital.
Well, Carmine, I'm going to promote the hell out of it, man.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I've got 5 music sites that are very, very popular. This interview will go on iTunes and iHeartRadio, YouTube, and I work with a site out in Belgium as well. So a lot of people pick up my show. So yeah, we're gonna promote the hell out of this.
But do you play the songs too?
No, we don't play the songs, but I do. I feature the songs on my website, on the websites.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
How come you don't play songs on the podcast?
Well, we could, but I'm strictly about the interview because it's like a 1-hour show.
Oh.
I may do that. I may do that in the future.
Yeah, you should do a little excuse us.
Yeah.
A minute is one, a couple, two or three.
Yeah, maybe we'll work on that. That's a good idea.
Yeah, because it's such a unique conglomeration of players.
Right.
All in one place. It's never been done before like that, you know. I mean, there have been compilation albums of like Queen or Alice Cooper or Jeff Beck or Led Zeppelin where you get, you know, a few guitar players on an album, but nobody's ever had so many on a record, you know, that wasn't a tribute record.
Right.
That's an all original songs, except The Thieving I'm Sexy, which I co-wrote, you know. But all the other songs are totally original. And the guys love these songs. I mean, Brian May called me when the album came out first. He said, man, I got a problem with the album. I said, oh, great. What's the problem? He goes, I played it for my staff, and everyone loved it so much, I need more copies. I said, oh, that's a good problem. You know?
I love your rendition of Do You Think I'm Sexy with Pat Travers. That's really very different.
Cool. We came up with that when we were rehearsing to do our tour. You know,
right.
We did a couple albums and then we toured, and you know we were doing a little bit of each of our history, and that one came up. I had a different like hard rock version of it, and Pat was playing a riff, and I said, hey, why don't we use that? And Do You Think I'm Sexy, that's a cool riff, you know. So that's what we did. We transformed the arrangement into the arrangement using Pat's riff. And then I said, look, I'll sing it, and then you should join me in the chorus, and you sing the bridge, you know. So that's what we did. So that's the only one on the record that I'm singing.
Another favorite is Cruisin', you know, because it doesn't...
Oh, yeah.
Denny Lane, I mean...
Denny
awesome.
Lane.
Yeah.
And that was I had a group called World Classic Rockers with Denny, and it was me and Denny, Bobby Kimball, and Randy Meisner,
right.
Eagles, and Spencer Davis, and two guys from
what a lineup!
Steppenwolf, and we go out and we play each other's songs, which is always a lot of fun.
Yeah,
I was doing this record, and I had done a movie with Kelly Keeling, our singer,
right?
Called Chasing Destiny. It had Roger Daltrey in it, and we wrote Angels for that movie, and I was in the studio with them, and I asked Denny if he'd put down, like, if he has something for a minute, I'd love to put him on the Guitarzish record, you know. He said, yeah, I have something, so we went to him in the studio, and he did that, and I thought it was pretty cool.
Well, it's a fantastic album, man. I you know, I recommend it highly to everybody. If people were stranded on a desert island with an MP3 or disc player, this would be the only album you would need to survive on. Believe me.
Thank you. I never thought of it like that.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It's all you need.
Hey.
Well, you got a lot of other projects going on, like you always do. Is there a band called Kodiak that you've been working on?
Yeah, I've been working on this band, Kodiak.
Right.
They are a, you know, this Greta Van Fleet band that seems to be exploding on the scene, that's sort of like Led Zeppelin. Well, my young band and the guitar player just turned 17, they do sort of like Van Halen music.
Right.
You know, it's like a guitar-oriented, you know, four-piece lineup.
Yep.
And they're really good, and I know the guitar player and the drummer. For 10 years, you know, the drummer just turned 22, and I know him since he was 11, you know, and I met the family, and I've been sort of mentoring over them for the last few years, and then in August I got really involved, and when they told me they wanted to try and move their music more Van Halen than they were, because they were like a punk band that had some Van Halen overtones.
Right.
And then they said, what about if we did, like, Van Halen, like Greta Van Fleet did Led Zeppelin? I said, that's a great idea, because labels are going to be looking for that now. You know? And so we had some showcases. We got a lot of interest in them. And it looks like in the next month or so, we're going to get a one or two tracks released just to start the ball rolling while we're still finishing the record deal, you know? And they're really good. They're really good. So we just did a showcase in New York at the Cutting Room. Got a few labels down there, a few agents.
Awesome.
And we're, you know, trying to get the thing finalized with a proper record deal. But in the meanwhile, we want to get into business. right. to do something. And the kids are always writing. They got a studio that their parents built in the house. So
right.
They're like Van Halen brothers, guitar and drums, you know?
Right.
So they put all the song ideas together in the house, and then they'll send them to me. You know, put a quick vocal on it, they'll send it to me, and I'll sort of, you know, like a butcher, I'll take the fat off, I'll add some spices to it, you know? And call them up and say, why don't you do this and do that, let's edit this. Let's bring up the key and the solo to another key. Let's cut that chorus in half or add more to the chorus or do the chorus in double time or, you know,
yeah.
Just add arrangements and hook lines and lots of hooks. Like Van Halen would do, you know?
Well,
it's funny because Van Halen used to listen to Cactus.
Right.
And like, there's a piece on a song called She Said.
Right.
That's sort of like Eruption.
Yep.
But Eruption came from a Cactus song called Let Me Swim.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same idea.
Yeah.
So it's all like a complete circle.
Carmine, I give you a lot of credit, man, because you take the time with these young performers to help them out, and also with your published books, you know, you help a lot of people out, and there's a lot of guys that don't want to do that after a certain time, you know, they don't want to mess with it.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to do it when I was a Vanilla Fudge. I was good. I was, you know, a rock star.
Right.
Then when I wrote my instructional book, Ludwig Drum Company explained to me that if you go out and do drum clinics, and we'll support you. We'll buy 1,000 books a year, and you'll sell books by doing the clinics.
Yep.
Like you go out on tour and sell records. I said that didn't make sense to me until then. So the first clinic I did for them was in Long Island, 1971, I think, and 1972, and the book had just come out, and I had 750 people at this clinic, and it was like crazy, you know. And I sold a lot of books, but Sam Ash was in the store. They right. bought the books.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ludwig put me on other clinics, and they bought books and bought books. And before you know it, the first year I sold 3,000 or 4,000 books, and that was like amazing. According to a friend of mine, Joe Morello, who's a jazz drummer, and had books out.
Right.
He said, what are you kidding me? That's like huge sales. I said, really? I was used to selling hundreds of thousands of records.
Right.
You know, and, you know, so 4,000 books didn't make sense. Today, I'm still selling 4,000 or 5,000 books, you know, and they sell more than a record sell, you know, because their record sales are, you know, down to nothing because everybody's streaming and downloading.
Well, I'm an author too, Carmine, and let me tell you, that's a lot of books. It is,
you know,
a lot of
books. I sold over 4,000 books.
That's not bad at all.
400,000 books.
That's amazing.
That book. And my other book, you know, I've done probably, the last count, 6,500, which is okay. They tell me that's still in the top 5% of books that come out, because
most
books that come out sell less than 500.
Yeah.
You know, but I thought, you know, recently it was going to be on VH1 Books, so I thought we were going to really do great. It'd be on the, you know, New York Times bestseller list.
Right.
They were distributed by a major company. But just as we finished the book, and they got me the writer, this guy Ian Giddens that wrote the Heroin Diaries with Mickey Six.
Right.
You know, we finished the book, and then VH1 went out of business.
Yeah.
So,
right.
So we had to go get another deal, and I didn't want to spend years trying to get another deal. So it took a while to get a book deal, because I'm not a lead singer, I'm a drummer. And I've heard that from the book companies. Well, if he was a lead singer, you know, in front of all the crowd, you know, the center of attraction, I said, boy, that's racist.
Yeah, it is. That's a bunch of crap.
Yeah, so we did get a deal with an indie company, but they, you know, when we first released the book, they printed 3,000. They sold the 3,000 out in the first 2 weeks. They were caught with their pants down.
Right.
And we had this momentum going. Then we lost the momentum because it took another 2 or 3 weeks to print up more copies.
Yeah.
You know, and like, you can't do that, you know.
Which one are you talking about? The realistic rock draw method? Are you?
My life is set from the actual autobiography book.
Right. That I didn't get to that yet, but I was talking about the realistic ruck drum method, which was in 1972.
Yeah, that one's been doing great. You know.
Yeah.
That book has got me the biggest drum publishing deals in the history of drum publishing books. You know, and it's done amazing. You know. Really done amazing. Still going.
Yeah, it's way back. So, it's like, what, the big anniversary coming up or something?
Well, and I guess in 2022, it'll be 60 years.
Holy crap.
Is that right?
That's unbelievable.
60 years. 72, 82, 92.
That's crazy.
2002, 2012.
Yeah.
50 years.
Yeah, 50 years, right.
Yeah,
you're not that old.
No, but I'm definitely older than 50.
Well, so am I.
Right.
Well, you also got, which is cool, Realistic Rock for Kids, which is awesome. You know, it's a book and two CDs. That's on Amazon. And, of course, you got Ultimate Realistic Rock Drum Method book with two CDs. And you've got so much great material on Amazon. It's incredible.
It's all on Amazon. You know,
on Amazon. Yeah.
You know, the books are still in the, all those books are still in various music stores,
right.
You know, that where there are music stores, you know, and some Barnes and Noble.
And of course, Stick It is My Life of Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll, which is an incredible story. You know, that everyone needs to, I wish the PR people would have sent me a link to the book or something, because I haven't got a chance to read it yet.
Oh, I don't think we have a link to the book.
You don't have it on PDF or anything?
No, because I didn't want to do that. We didn't want to send it out to anybody in a PDF.
Right.
And then that's how you get bootlegged.
Well, my book got bootlegged.
What's that?
I'm an author, too, and my last book got bootlegged. You know, it's out everywhere.
I don't want to do that. It's bad enough that Realistic Rock is bootlegged.
I know. I'm not getting paid for a lot of stuff.
So, I mean, I was going to do that, and then I said, you know what? I'm not going to do that, because then, you know, somebody's going to send it to somebody somehow.
Right.
Somebody gets a hold of it from them, and then they... Next thing you know, it's on some website, you know, and then there goes all my autobiography sales.
But Carmine, does your music on YouTube, do you get paid at all for any of that stuff?
Say again?
Do you get paid from YouTube, from anything that you put on YouTube, the album?
Not that I know of.
Really? Oh, man.
I don't put stuff on YouTube.
That's other people that do it. Yeah.
I don't really... You know, I never got into that, you know, as an income stream, because it's so my niche.
Because, you know, Guitar Zeus, a lot of the songs are on YouTube.
They're all on YouTube, and then, the labels put them up, you know, as promotion.
Right.
You know, so the labels, like in this case, if we put up Guitar Zeus that my label put up, yes, I'll make some money off, and that's what my guy Robert DePaul is trying to monetize all this stuff that's on the YouTube about me.
Good.
You know, so, but I haven't seen a dime from any of it.
Yeah, it's a different world today, isn't it?
It is. It's not about making money off the sales of your product. It's about going out and playing it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but, you know, I mean, I'm not getting enough, hits on YouTube to make a difference in our gigs.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, we're talking about people are making 20 million views on YouTube. Yeah, come on, my biggest one is probably BBA 1.8 or Blue Murder 1.8. That's not me personally.
Yeah.
You know, it's a band. But even so, you know, even when you keep hanging on, we've been up to 1.5-2 million views. And then for some reason it comes down, starts again, get another 2 million views.
Right.
You know, but it doesn't make a difference in the attendance, really.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, a lot of people cheat on YouTube, too. They buy the views.
Oh, yeah, I know. I know. I tried to do that with Twitter. Remember when I first started Twitter? Somebody said, hey, you can buy Twitter views. You know, so I bought 5,000 Twitters. By the time I bought them, and then like 2 months later, 4,000 fell off.
No, same thing happened to me. I did the same thing.
So it's like, that was a waste of time.
I know.
Yeah. But, you know, I personally, I don't think anything really sells for my audience.
Right.
On Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff. You know, I mean, it's good to, you know, anytime I put up something about, like, I just released a new album, or I got a gig coming up, I don't get that much response from that.
Right.
I get more response out of, a cool picture of me playing with Blue Murder.
Right, right.
You know, something that, you know, I guess is different, you know. I guess these Facebook and Twitter and all these people don't want to look at something like it's an advertisement.
Yeah.
You know, unless you buy a banner or an advertising on Facebook.
Right.
And I don't really think it works that much, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I did some gigs with me and my brother that did the total Facebook advertising. We had 40 people there.
Yeah.
Normally, you know, we do 300 people.
Right.
On normal advertising. You know, 300-400 people, you know? And, you know, so I don't really think that Facebook stuff works.
Well, the live concerts, you know, you sell out all the live concerts, and especially every time you're with, you know, like a bunch of other legendary bands, you know, like you did with Hit, the Rock and Blues Fest, Hippie Fest, and all that kind of stuff, you know, and Ringo's got a good, you know, the way Ringo's and his all-star band does it, that's a great way to do it, I think.
Yeah, people approach me, said, why don't you do like Ringo does?
Right.
Just bring out, I mean, that's what we have. We have this Platinum Rock All-Stars.
Right.
You know, which goes out now, and there's different versions of it. Different versions had Gene Cornish from the Rascals, yep. Had Bumblefoot, had me, Rudy Sarzo, and Jeff Downs from Yes. You know, and we go out, we did a few gigs, and it went well. But then
right.
It's very difficult to get everybody scheduled again.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, in Ringo's case, you know, it doesn't matter who his band is. You know, as Ringo All Stars, he's going to play 5,000-6,000 seat arenas anyway.
Yeah, right.
So he can promise an artist, well, I got a 3-month tour, and they $7,500 a week. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't have that kind of power.
Right. Yeah, Flo and Eddie. Flo and Eddie does a good job too. You know.
Yeah. You know, there's a. That happened together tour,
right.
But I understand they're having problems with it this year.
Really? I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, we're doing something called Legends of in Rock, Legends of Rock tour with Vanilla Fudge, I think 10 years after, and a few other ones.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That should be good.
But it's different, you know. I mean, I'd like to do it. I would love to do an All-Star Guitars tour, but, you know, nobody knows the album yet.
Right.
You know, and even if it does okay, it's not going to be like in the old days. And if you sold 300,000 or 400,000 records, you can go out with that.
Right.
You know, now, you know, you don't even know what you're selling.
Yeah, it's totally different nowadays, you know?
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, so. I'm glad that I grew up and I made it in an era where you actually made money on your records,
right.
And you made money on your live performances. And we came in at a time where everything was virgin, you know, including radio.
Right.
The FM underground radio was like,
yep.
You know, FM underground, you know.
Yeah, we missed that. You know, I was a top 40 DJ back in the late 70s. And even back then, the music was, it was a nice mix. There's a lot of disco and stuff, but we had new wave and, you know, all that.
Yeah, everything was played.
Yeah. It wasn't a bad time. But you're right, you know, radio sucks.
Yeah, I mean, my girlfriend's in radio, so she'll be in New York on the radio chick.
Yeah, she's been there. You guys have been together forever, right? Pretty much?
Yeah, 15 years we've been together.
15 years, yeah. Congratulations.
That market she had, like 800,000 people a day listen to her in New York.
In New York.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, there's nobody doing that stuff anymore.
Well,
because they won't put it on the radio anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, Howard Stern went to Sirius.
Right.
And he got that amazing, all that amazing money from Sirius. I don't even know if they ever made it back. You know? But, you don't hear any of that stuff. I mean, there's a few around the country. I know there's one in L.A. like that, Morning Show, and another one in Connecticut, you know, that I did some stuff with. But, you know, that kind of radio doesn't exist anymore.
There's a lot of great new albums by these like legendary artists. You know, I just had Leo Lyons on the show not long ago, from 10 Years After, and you know, he's with a new band, and you know, there's no like you said, there's no radio, there's no outlet to play their music. You know,
and there's no magazines.
No, you know,
like in Europe,
right?
There was never radio,
right?
There was lots of magazines, you know, and a little bit of radio. So now we have a little bit of radio and no magazines.
Yeah.
What you have is the internet. And by the internet, you never know how many people are listening or what your market is, you know, how many people are there. And it's not like, well, we sell 100,000 magazines a month. Or, you know, but now you don't know what you get. Even with podcasts, you don't know really what you're getting. You know what I'm saying?
Podcasting's gotten popular, though.
You may know,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
You know, but as far as numbers go, you know, it's not like they played on a Q104 in New York, steady play. Yeah, you got hundreds of thousands of people listening to you every
day. That's true.
You know, I mean, the numbers are nothing like that now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people say, well, how do you find new bands? Guess what? I don't.
Yep.
Because I don't have the time to sit around on YouTube and put in new bands and sit there and listen, you know? I mean, I used to turn on the radio and hear new bands.
Yeah.
So it's kind of messed up.
Well, that plus record stores, you know? I used to hunt for, you know, album, really cool album covers, you know? And they go, wow, I think I'll give these guys a listen, you know?
It used to be fun going to a record store.
Yeah.
And just browse around, you know,
right.
You had everything that, you know, then turn to CDs, you had CDs and records, and you had DVDs, and you had merch, you know, there's none of that now.
No.
They got places of myself for merch, like Hot Tropic or something, you know, but nobody sells any records, you know. Amoeba in LA, I hear that they have a rough time. But in Japan, they still have Tower Records, and they have a bunch of them. And they still sell records and CDs.
Yeah, like even another great avenue there is Holland. Holland's still into all the rock, you know, the back in the...
Yeah.
They never gave it up, you know?
And again, they have all the magazines.
Yep, you're right.
That are sold in the record stores too, probably.
Yeah.
You know, and it's too bad. This country has become digitized, and to the point where, you know, you get played on Sirius Radio, you don't know who's listening.
True.
They have no way to count how many people are listening to that particular channel.
That's right.
You know, because they have, what, 150 channels?
Yeah.
Or more? You know? So you get played on, like, we were playing with Vanilla Fudge on Underground Garage. We didn't see any spike in record sales. Mm-hmm. Not a spike in anything.
Yeah.
You know? Like, when we went on the Ed Sullivan Show, forget about it.
Right.
Spike, unbelievable.
Sure.
You know? Or you got played on nationwide radio all the time. Or you played in all the major cities all the time. You see the spikes.
Well, Carmine, what about, remember like the Midnight Special in you remember the Midnight Special in concert and Don Kirshner?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
We were on there with Jeff Beck.
Yeah, I mean, that was unbelievable.
That was a great show.
It was a great show,
That show that we did, two of the songs that we did are on YouTube.
Right.
Superstition keeps getting 100, 1.8 million views, and then it falls off.
I checked that out.
Again, yep. It's back again, 1.8 million views.
Right.
You know, and there's one called Morning Dew that doesn't get as many views. It's got about 30, 40, 50,000. And I sing that, I look and I go, holy crap. I'm singing my ass off and I'm playing my ass off at the same time. You know, now, you hear my voice, I keep getting allergies and colds, yeah. and always affects my voice. So right now, I'm looking hoarse.
You got a great voice.
We're going to do 4 vanilla fight shows. And,
yeah.
And I know some of the notes I'm going to want to hit for people to get ready,
yep.
I'm not going to get because of this hoarseness.
Yeah.
You know?
No, you got a great voice, man. You really do.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
I want to mention a couple things. I think you're working on an unreleased Beck Bogart and a piece live concert from the Rainbow in London. Is that something you're working on?
Well, we have one mixed, so we're just trying to see if we can get it out.
Okay.
You know, it really is great, and I think Jeff approved it, and his manager and our manager are working out, trying to work on a record deal. And
right.
We'll let him take the lead, his manager, but, you know, so far it's been a while and they haven't really finished it yet. So we'll see. Hopefully it'll come out.
Okay. And you're working on Cactus, maybe a 50th anniversary celebration?
Yeah, we're working on stuff for Cactus.
Right.
We're working on a new album. So McCarty is retired,
yep.
from Cactus.
Right.
Because he can't go on the road anymore. And we said, well, if you can't go on the road, no use to put him on the album. So we've got Paul Warren that played with Rod Stewart for 14 years, and he played with Tina Turner and Joe Cocker. And I found him, and I told him, he's from Detroit. Detroit. He used to sneak in to see Cactus play to different venues.
Right.
He was on the H. And he plays very similar to McCarty, except with a lot more energy, speed. I call it McCarty on 10. You know, square 10. He's just amazing. You know, so we've been doing new songs, and it sounds like Cactus.
Huh.
And we got the new bass player, James Caputo, who plays with me and my brother in our Drum War show. And he's a lot more like Tim than Pete Blaney was, you know. And we don't need him to sing high parts because Paul Warren's a great singer.
Right.
So we still have the three-part harmony when we need it with the lead singer, Jimmy Coons. But Jimmy Caputo's playing is just... God, he's amazing, you know, and he sounds like Tim. So the band still sounds a lot like Cactus, except now the material has really gone up a notch, you know, and it's really kick-ass and it's really good songs. And the funny thing about Paul Warren is when he was 17, the first thing he ever played on that was a hit was Poppin' Like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
By the Temptations.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So we just did a new rendition of that. Rendition of that for this album, because the last shows we did last year, we would tell the people, you know, that, you know, Paul, when he was 17, he played on a song you might know. We're going to do that song for you now. We did that song, and they went crazy over that song. You know? So we said, you know, we should record it. So we came up with a cool rendition of it now that we've been working on. It really sounds great. And all the tracks we're doing are kick-ass. They're really great. And we have one slower blues that's really, really cool, too.
What, one of my favorite Cactus songs has always been Evil, the Howlin' Wolf classic.
Yeah, I think that's... If anyone would say... One of the most famous Cactus songs, I'd say Evil and Parchment Farm.
Right.
Right. And Parchment Farm was the predecessor to How to Teach It. That was the blueprint. That's what Alex told me.
Yeah. You know?
And Evil is being done by so many different bands. And I just got an email from somebody that represents Clutch, the group Clutch.
Right.
Yeah, they're going in the studio right about now, and they're going to record Evil. Another group called Blackstone Cherry did evil.
Oh, yeah.
I know D. Schneider did evil.
Yep.
Greta Van Fleet does evil live. Me and Pat Travis did evil. I think evil is one of the most famous Cactus songs.
And then with Beck Bogart and the piece, I think Superstition is probably one of the highlights.
Yeah, well, that's the one.
Yeah.
Because that one was written for Jeff by Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
By the time we recorded and got it out, he had Motown heard his demo for Death that he wrote for Jeff. You know, that we changed. So when they wanted it out immediately, they released it. It went to number one. Then when Oz came out, it sounded like a cover.
Right.
Our lyrics are a little different.
Oh, it's a great tune.
Song was written for Jeff by Stevie.
Yeah.
So, it's a crazy story.
You guys nailed it, man.
And, yeah, it was a great song.
Yeah. And, of course, what you played with Pink Floyd, one of my favorite albums has always been Momentary Lapse of Reason. And when my daughter was young, I used to scare the crap out of her with Dogs of War.
Well, there you go. When Bob Ezrin called me and said he took my... I'm producing an album that's just screaming for Carmine Drum Film.
Uh-oh.
And I said, well, who's the band? And he said, Pink Floyd. I go, where's Nick?
Yeah.
He said, Nick will be there. It's, they wanted some new blood and some new energy. I said, wow. I went down, spent the day, and it was quite an experience. It was great.
Yeah, you and Jim Keltner, I think, were all on the album, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm on just one track. That's the one track they wanted me on. Which is fine, because that was the most high-energy drum extravaganza track on the album.
Yeah, I heard the way you first listened to it, you went to a record store and bought a cassette tape.
Yeah, because I recorded so many 24 tracks worth of drums, and they were putting it all together. I kept calling Bob, saying, hey, how's it going? He goes, oh, in a word, fantastic. You know, like, okay. I said, when's it done? Well, in a few weeks, call me back. I call him back. How's it going now? You know, one word, tremendous. I go, Jesus, Randy. I said, when can I hear something? That kept happening. Eventually, I was in Canada doing a movie called Black Roses. And I heard the Pink Floyd record came out, so I went downstairs to the record store where they had record stores. And I bought the cassette, and I listened to it on my Walkman. I was blown away. Because he put all the different drum parts together, and I came up with an amazing drum part.
Did you ever see the film, you know, the live concert film for that song, you know, with the wolves with the red eyes?
I think I did. Yeah. Nick played it, right? Nick played it.
That,
it was live. Nick Mason had to play it, right?
Right, right. But
I saw it on TV.
Yeah, it's so cool.
You know, I think I saw it on TV, and I was going, ah, look, Nick trying to play my drum fill. That's pretty cool.
I just want to point out a couple of things from the book. One was your relationship with Sharon Osbourne. I'm Facebook friends with Lee Kerslick, and he's tickled pink that he finally got credit, you know, from that from his albums with Ozzy, you know, because he had an issue with Sharon for a long, long time, not getting credit.
What's the credit? He got the gold album, you mean?
Yeah, he finally got the gold album.
Yeah, well, he got screwed out of millions of dollars.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel sorry. Lee's, you know, he's sick. You know, he's got cancer.
I know.
Yeah.
Really.
Nice guy, you know.
I saw him at the Heavy Metal Awards in L.A., the Hall of Fame Awards.
Right.
And I had Kodiak play on that show. Me and Vinny headlined the show that night. My brother. And I saw Lee, and he gained a lot of weight.
Yeah.
I know him from Uriah Heep days.
Yeah.
When we used to tour with Cactus. I got to know him really well. And I ran into him a bunch of times in Europe. And, you know, when I heard about this thing with the album, I said, unbelievable. I don't even have a gold album for that album.
Yeah.
I should have it.
Right.
So I'm on it. And I was a co-producer on the 500 $100,000.
Right.
And then she took me off it.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
But I was definitely on it.
Yeah.
And, she's just unbelievable, you know. She screwed a lot. She screwed Bob Daisley, too.
Right.
Screwed him. Screwed a lot of musicians on the way up.
Yeah, Ozzy sits quietly, just letting her do whatever. He just minds his own business, I guess.
Ozzy's the kind of guy that he needs to live.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, when they were putting that band together, Ozzy was sitting next to me at the Rainbow, and I was talking to him, and I turned around and talked to a fan, turned my face back, and Ozzy's face was in his plate of spaghetti. You know? So one of the stories in my book, and my brother Vinny was asked to join the original band, and I said, where's it going to go? Like, I can't even, you know, sit at a table without this face falling into a bowl of spaghetti. So it would have probably been my brother Vinny on that.
Right, right.
That first album, that's he would have got screwed.
Yeah, but you told him not to do it, right?
I told him not to do it.
Yeah.
He ended up being in Sabbath instead, you know?
Right.
And then I ended up playing with them. And they called me, you know? I mean, they called me. I didn't call them.
Yeah.
They wanted me to join the band. They said Tommy Aldridge wasn't doing the job and blah, blah, blah. And then after, you know, me being on the road with them and I was doing master classes every day, getting a lot of press, she didn't like that.
Yeah.
She was pushing Jakey Lee, but she fired me and got Tommy Aldridge back.
Yeah.
Well, so what was the reason for doing that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But hey, gave me a play with Ozzy credit, so that's all right.
Sure. Well, in the book, it says you slept with 4,500 groupies. Is that true?
Well, pretty close. We worked it out.
Jeez.
On a spreadsheet.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, but, you know, it was crazy days.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, for the last 15 years, it's not the state the same.
Of course. I hope so.
Yeah, well, before that, it never did, so.
The life of a rock star, man, I'm telling you.
But being with Leslie, a radio chick, you know, it was life-changing for me, you know. She's a great woman.
Now, you hung out with Telly Savalas, right?
Yeah.
Well, what was he like? I love Kojak, man. He was awesome.
He's a nice guy. Yeah. A really nice guy. Yeah, I brought him to Rod Stewart gigs, and one of my ex-wives was his niece, you know. So when I started playing with Rod, we would go to England. He had an apartment in England. So she would go with me, and sometimes, you know, we would... If I was going out on the road from London for a few days, she would go stay with him. Then when I come back, I got some days off. We would go to the casinos and go to different places with him. And I brought him to see Rod Stewart Group at Wembley, and Rod was very excited because he was a fan of Telly also.
Sure.
You know, yeah, there's some pictures on the internet of it.
I saw that. That's a great picture, man. Looks like you're having a good time there.
Yeah, it was good. It was good fun.
Yeah. And the, you know, we were talking about the way the music industry is now, but, you know, we know back in your day, there were some shady characters. But, you know, I talked to Tommy James, and of course, he had the Morris Levy thing, you know.
Yeah.
And you guys had, is it Philip Basile, the Lucchese crime?
Phil Basile,
from the Lucchese crime family member that was your manager.
He was our manager.
Yeah, but that's the way things were back then.
He was, but he wasn't like a totally connected. He was connected, but he wasn't like, you know, out there every day doing. He was doing his own business, you know.
Right.
I don't know if he. I'm sure that he paid those guys off, you know, because I remember some of my roadies would say that they would take a bag. Say, hey, take this bag to Paulie. It's a brown paper bag stapled together. So what do you think was in there?
You know, my family, my dad's family grew up in Bensonhurst. So they grew up, you know, he's Jewish. They had the Jewish side, the Italian side. He grew up with a lot of those mob guys, too, you know, and yeah. I met a lot of those guys.
I used to play at their social clubs.
Oh, really?
As a kid, oh, yeah. Book. You got to get a copy of the book.
I got to. It looks awesome, man.
Oh, man.
I mean, you played with everybody.
No, I mean, I have to really think about that. The Beatles.
The Beatles, yeah?
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Just fill in for Ringo? Take Ringo's place?
Yeah, I mean, Ringo was... I thought Ringo did a great job because I think he created... You know, it made famous, like, the drummer not just playing backbeat, you know, doing drum parts and songs, you know?
He was a good drummer. He was a really good drummer.
Yeah.
He is.
You know, but he created drum parts.
Right.
You know,
right.
You know, a lot of those early Beatles tracks. It wasn't just, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. It was like, you know, blah, blah, blah. It was part of the thing. Then the show, which was vocals, that became part of the song, you know, part of the melody of the song.
Vanilla Fudge was, you guys were inspired by the Revolver album, right?
Yep, totally.
Tomorrow Never Knows. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, cool.
You know, a lot of people said that, you should have taken over for, the Who for Keith Moon when Keith Moon passed away.
Well, I was with the Coin Management at the time.
Right.
And they actually, the Who people called them and asked them if I would be interested, and I said yes.
Right.
But then I never heard nothing.
Huh.
Then Joe Bonham died, and then it was rumors I was going to be, me and Cozy Powell were going to join Led Zeppelin.
Right.
But that didn't happen either. I would have liked to play with the Who. I always liked the Who.
Yeah. Yeah, you would have fit in either way, you know, with Zeppelin or the Who. It would have been
fun. I would have definitely fit in.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. I could have made myself fit in. If I didn't fit in, I could have made myself
sure.
So I could adjust my playing to whatever situation is.
Well, Carmine, you're an incredible drummer, man. You're to me, you know, the top three of all time. One of my favorites as well is Billy Cobham. You know, he's a friend. Also, I've had Billy on the show many times.
I didn't hear what you said, Billy Cobham.
Billy Cobham, yeah.
Yeah, Billy's a great guy.
Yeah.
I know Billy a long time.
You, when I think of drummers, I always think of, drummers today that haven't passed away. You and Billy Cobham are my favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll keep going. He's a little older than me.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He's from Panama.
Yeah. Yeah.
Living in Switzerland.
He's in Switzerland now, I think.
Yeah. Carmine, thank you, man, for being on the show today. I know you got some gigs coming up with Vanilla Fudge, and you got all kinds of things happening. We appreciate everything you do. Thank you for all the great music, and I hope to see you again in Florida.
Okay. See you soon, man.
All right, man. You take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye. Purchase Carmine Appice Guitar Zeus. Available at Amazon.com. Also, Vanilla Fudge Live at Sweden Rock 2016. Spirit of 67 from Vanilla Fudge, which came out in 2015, is also an incredible album. And Carmine's book, Stick It, My Life of Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll. Available also on Amazon.com. A fantastic read. For more information about Carmine Appice, visit www.carmineappice.net. He's also on Twitter, twitter.com/CarmineAppice1. Yeah, you can also visit the Vanilla Fudge site at vanillafudge.com, www.vanillafudge.com. And they're also on Facebook, www.facebook.com/vanillafudgeofficialsite. Very special thanks to the wonderful Ann Layton of Media Music Services and Motivation for arranging this interview with Karma and Peace. And of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.